This episode features discussion of kidnapping and graphic violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. China, 1936. It was early morning at the Huaqing Hot Springs, an ancient palace just over 20 miles outside the city of Xi'an.
A thin layer of fresh snow covered the grounds, past the lotus pool with its carved stone dragon heads, through a group of richly ornamented pavilions, in a small comfortable room, the most powerful man in all of China, the Generalissimo, was performing his morning exercises.
Outside, 120 armed men descended on the compound. They had been warned that their prisoner was to be taken alive and unharmed at all costs.
The first shots rang out as the invading forces moved through the complex, quickly dispatching the guard stationed in the courtyard. Upon hearing the commotion, the Generalissimo's bodyguard ran outside. A gunfight erupted.
As bullets flew through the door of his study, the Generalissimo realized he was cornered. He took the only way out, jumping through a nearby window, leaving behind his uniform, shoes, and even his dentures.
Toothless and shoeless, the Generalissimo made his way through the snow to a 10-foot wall. On the other side was a steep drop-off into the dry moat below.
He was cornered. Behind him, almost all his men lay dead or injured. In front of him lay a perilous descent into a dry gulch, and beyond that, the cold and unforgiving woods. The enemy that sought him was moving ever closer, and the only way to go was down.
This is Hostage, the new Parcast podcast telling the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can listen to all of Parcast's podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is by leaving a 5-star review wherever you listen.
This is our first episode on the kidnapping of Chinese nationalist leader Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, an event also known as the Xi'an Incident.
In 1936, northern China was being torn apart, first by a brutal civil war between the communists and the nationalists, then by the invasion of Japanese forces. Strong-willed nationalist leader Chiang Kai-shek was uncompromising. His armies would not fight the Japanese attacks until the communist threat had been entirely eliminated.
Horrified at the prospect of losing their homeland to Japan, two of Chiang Kai-shek's generals decided to take matters into their own hands. If Chiang Kai-shek would not lead his armies willingly against the Japanese, then he would just have to do so by force.
This week, we'll look at Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, how he was blindsided by his own generals. We'll also explore the motivations of the two men who masterminded the whole event, Zhang Shuliang and Yang Hucheng. Next week, we'll investigate the negotiations for Chiang Kai-shek's release, the psychology behind his subsequent change of policy, and the 14 days that would change history forever. Chiang Kai-shek is one of the most controversial figures in Chinese history. To some, he was a tyrannical despot hungry for power. To others, he was a leader doing his best for a country on the brink of collapse.
On October 31st, 1887, in a modest home in the small village of Chico, Chiang Kai-shek was born to a well-liked salt merchant and his wife. His father passed away when Chiang was 5, leaving his stern disciplinarian mother to support the small family all on her own. Throughout his life, he would revere his mother as an almost saintly figure.
In fact, years after her death, he gave a speech saying, quote, Now that the trees by her grave have grown tall and thick, I cannot but realize how little I have accomplished and how I have failed to live up to the hopes she placed in me," end quote. At the time, he was the most powerful man in China.
Chang's devotion to his mother had more to do with his image of himself than it did with any actual flesh and blood woman. In Chinese culture of the early 1900s, a man had to admit his own inadequacies. The best way for Chang to do that was by constantly holding himself up to the impossible ideal of his mother that he had created in his mind.
Chang's mother lived a harsh life. She often didn't have time to provide him with the attention he longed for. This led to what historian Pishan Lo characterizes as a crisis personality.
According to Lo, a crisis personality is marked by, quote, an inability to respond normally and in due proportion to a wide range of emotional situations, while at the same time feeling challenged and psychologically fulfilled when confronted with a crisis, end quote. This developed from young Chang's realization that he could get the attention he wanted by manufacturing crises.
As a child, Chang often suffered severe cuts and burns, and in one instance, he almost drowned. All of this merited attention, so he continued to put himself in dangerous situations.
Well, this recklessness later served him well, allowing him to take military risks that others shied away from. Lo says that Chang would feel more normal or creative in situations that required leadership and authority and offered suitable opportunities for the projection of his anxieties and suspicions.
In his adolescence, Chang set his sights on military school in the rapidly modernizing nation of Japan.
In 1905, he sailed to Japan, only to learn that for a Chinese citizen to attend a Japanese military school, he needed a letter from the Chinese Board of War in Peking. Disappointed and embarrassed, Chang returned home to Shiko.
A year later, he left home again, this time for Shanghai and a Chinese military academy, although he hadn't yet given up on Japan. In 1907, he sat for an entrance exam to a Japanese army school and was one of 40 candidates selected for transfer.
In Japan, Chang found a small circle of politically minded students who introduced him to the revolutionary teachings of Sun Yat-sen.
Sun Yat-sen believed in three basic principles: the unification of an ethnically diverse Chinese nation, a democratic government free from imperial or monarchical control, and a system of social welfare that would ensure the most basic needs of the Chinese people.
Chang immediately took to Sun Yat-sen's cult of personality and revolutionary dogma, joining an underground resistance movement, the Tongmonghui.
In the fall of 1911, Chang received a coded telegram from a friend in China. The revolution was underway. He obtained a permit for a 48-hour leave of absence from school.
At dinner that night, Chang and other Chinese nationals drank a toast, symbolizing their willingness to die in battle. While the other participants took a sip or two, Chang drained his glass.
He was all in. The following day, he sailed for Shanghai. From there, he traveled south to his home province of Zhejiang, where he organized a unit of 100 soldiers.
In the early morning hours of November 5th, 1911, Chang's impromptu army surrounded the Zhejiang governor's headquarters.
The troops lobbed homemade bombs through the windows of the governor's mansion. Chang watched the house burn, filled with a patriotic fervor. By Christmas, the revolution was complete.
Sun Yat-sen was inaugurated president of the new Chinese Republic on New Year's Day, 1912. Though the new president was a great thinker and revolutionary, his ideology was ill-defined when it came to actually implementing his vision. Even those close to him described him as impractical and scatterbrained.
As a result, the government that emerged was completely unstable. By February of 1912, Sun Yat-sen tendered his resignation and ceded control to a monarchic loyalist named Yuan Shikai.
Chang remained fiercely loyal to Sun Yat-sen. In 1913, he led an unsuccessful rebellion attempt against Yuan Shikai. He spent the following years hiding out in Shanghai, avoiding retribution by Yuan's imperialist forces.
By 1917, the monarchic forces were fully ousted, allowing a fledgling democracy to take root, with Sun Yat-sen as generalissimo. The nationalist government, or Kuomintang, was a weak democracy with an elected governing body. It was especially prone to corruption.
Chiang was rewarded for his loyalty with an appointment as military counselor. In this mid-level role, he commanded a large part of the army under the direct supervision of another higher-level general.
Though he was an ambitious military commander and adept at political manipulation, one of Chiang's political colleagues described his unreasonable fury and called Chiang extremely self-willed to an almost incorrigible extent.
While visiting the rival of a friend in the hospital, Chiang and the man got into an argument.
In response, Chiang pulled out a pistol and shot the man until he was dead.
His short temper and sense of superiority made him powerful enemies within the Kuomintang. He would have to find another way to curry favor with Sun Yat-sen and work his way into a position of power.
In 1922, Chiang seized an opportunity to impress his mentor. The new government was once again under threat of collapse. In the remote provinces of the country, away from the centers of power, warlords had formed small military dictatorships.
One of these warlords was Yang Hucheng, Chiang's future kidnapper. But the two didn't meet quite yet.
The nationalists tried to fight the warlords, but instead of a real army, they only had mercenary forces, and their resources were quickly drained.
Instead of relying on soldiers for hire, they needed a force motivated by Sun's principles, who had a genuine concern for the fate of China. Chiang could create such an army.
Under the counsel of Sun Yat-sen, Chiang opened the Wanpo Military Academy in 1924. There, young men between the ages of 15 and 25 were instructed in military strategy and indoctrinated with Sun's three principles.
In November of 1924, Sun Yat-sen visited Wanpo. Chiang led him around the academy and showed him the cadets. Sun Yat-sen was pleased by what he saw. But when he left the next morning for Peking, he delivered a cryptic warning that he might not return.
In truth, Sun Yat-sen's health was failing. In January, he was diagnosed with incurable liver cancer, and by March of 1925, he was dead.
The fledgling Kuomintang government was without a leader. Coming up, we'll dive into the chaotic aftermath of Sun Yat-sen's death.
And now, back to the story.
Sun Yat-sen's death in 1925 triggered a scramble for power among the top-ranking members of the Kuomintang. To his frustration, Chiang Kai-shek found himself seventh in line for the position of chairman of the political council.
The position of chairman was now the highest position of power in China. It's a little confusing, but during this chaotic period, the top leader's title switched several times between president, generalissimo, and chairman. Essentially, every time China had a new leader, they took a different title than their predecessor had. Luckily for Chiang, this latest iteration of the democratic nationalist government was saturated with corruption. With a little work and a lot of cunning, he would narrow down his competition.
Chiang was especially talented at pitting his enemies against each other. When one of Chiang's rivals was shot outside the Kuomintang central offices, Chiang was put on the committee investigating the crime. He pinned the crime on the two men who were third and fourth in the line of succession.
When another rival suffered a defeat at the hands of a warlord, Chiang took the opportunity to reorganize his troops. The defeated general was then sent away to recuperate from what he termed as brain trouble.
Chiang faced his final challenger on March 18, 1927. He was scheduled to take a steamer to Wanpo that day, but that morning, his wife received a series of strange phone calls from the wife of Chiang's only remaining political rival, Wang Jinwei. she insisted on knowing what time Chang would be leaving for Whampoa and which jetty he would arrive at.
Chang's wife was suspicious and informed her husband of the calls. He, in turn, phoned Whampoa and learned that the Kuomintang's flagship gunboat had been stationed nearby. The communist captain reported that the ship sailed there on Chang's orders. Chang refuted this.
There are several theories on what actually caused the odd set of circumstances known as the Zongsan warship incident. No matter the truth, Chang saw an opportunity to take down his final obstacle.
Chang assumed control of the gunboat and arrested the captain, as well as other communists at Whampoa. He accused Wang of aiding a communist plot to kidnap and assassinate him. It wasn't long before the ailing Wang Jingwei tendered his resignation. Chang was finally chairman of the Kuomintang, but his hold on power was tenuous. On March 21st of 1927, Chang's communist allies had driven the warlords out of Shanghai at Chang's behest, but now they were loath to give up the city.
But Chang had a trick up his sleeve.
The Green Gang ran the rough underside of Shanghai. Chang had long relied on the gangsters to maintain his alliances, but Chang offered them a new deal. He would guarantee them immunity and a monopoly on the lucrative Shanghai drug trade if they would help him get rid of the rising communist threat.
On April 12, 1927, the streets of Shanghai were quiet, the city still asleep. A fleet of foreign cars sliced through the dirty haze of fog, moving past the docks and factories, the beggars sleeping in the streets, and the calmed facades of offices and banks.
At 4 a.m., a single gunshot, followed by the whistle of a gunboat, gave the signal. 1,500 members of the Green Gang began their assault.
The city erupted into chaos. Men were beheaded in the streets. A group of protesters, many of them women and children, were fired upon by machine guns. The death toll from the morning alone was somewhere between 400 and 500, and it only got worse from there.
One young woman had the audacity to say that Chang did not represent Sun Yat-sen's three principles. She was disemboweled by the Green Gang, her intestines wrapped around her body while she was still alive.
Atrocities like this were not uncommon in the Great Purge. From April to July of 1927, the death toll is estimated at around 34,000. As for Chang, he was over 200 miles away in Nanking, safely hidden away from the carnage.
In the months that followed, Chang seemed unbeatable. He reduced the communist forces to a fraction of what they had been and made a strategic new alliance with a young general. He would become one of China's most unlikely heroes and one of Chang's kidnappers. Zhang Shuliang was born to a military life. His peasant grandfather moved the family to the northern region of China, known as Manchuria, in search of a better future. Shuliang's father, Zhang Zualin, became one of the most powerful warlords in northern China.
In China, the surname comes first and is followed by the given name, hence Zhang Shuliang and Zhang Zualin. From here on, we'll refer to the elder Zhang by his nickname, the Old Marshal, in order to avoid confusion.
Japan had long sought control over northern China in order to increase their power on the world stage. They saw the turmoil in the wake of Sun Yat-sen's political revolution as the perfect opportunity to seize this land. In the Old Marshal, they saw an ideal temporary ally, easily manipulated and disposable when convenient.
They offered him financial aid, military support, and the ability to remain independent of the growing nationalist government. In return, he would allow the Japanese to gain a small foothold in Manchuria. It was an enticing prospect, and from 1911 until 1928, it made the Old Marshal a rich and powerful man, gaining him control over most of Manchuria as a warlord.
But as the nationalists grew in power, the Old Marshal started to rethink his Japanese alliance. The things he had once stood to gain from the Japanese were no longer of use to him. He now had land, money, and power.
As the supremacy of the Kuomintang became inevitable, the old marshal sought a new partnership.
The Japanese were not blind to the old marshal's machinations. When they saw how the tide was turning, they plotted his assassination and planned to replace him with a new ally. They hoped that his son, Zhang Xueliang, would be easier to control and more amenable to Japanese interests.
On June 3, 1928, the old marshal peered out the window of a train as it rumbled through the darkened Chinese countryside. A thin man with a drooping mustache, today he looked even more haggard than usual. He'd been warned of a possible assassination plot by the Japanese, but he knew that he still held military control over almost every part of the route the train was set to travel. Almost every part.
As the train passed over a bridge, an explosion caused one of the stone arches to crack and give way. The train derailed, and an enormous piece of masonry from the bridge smashed into the old marshal's private car. By the time he was pulled from the wreckage, the old man was bleeding heavily from his nose and a wound in his arm.
The old marshal lay on the cold ground outside, his blood soaking into the dusty earth. Eventually, a car arrived to take him to safety, but by the time the old marshal had arrived at a nearby hospital, the floor of the car was flooded with blood.
As he was carried from the car on a stretcher, the old marshal vomited blood. He lifted his head feebly, taking in the morning sun as it peeked over the horizon. He knew that it was the last sunrise he would ever see.
It was also the day of his son's 27th birthday, the last one Zhang Xueliang would openly celebrate. If the Japanese had hoped for a more pliant ally in Zhang Xueliang, they had shattered that hope when they assassinated his father.
For the rest of his life, Zhang would harbor anger at the Japanese.
While the old marshal had been a pragmatic warlord, concerned with power and survival, Zhang was a modern man, a product of the new century. He was motivated by a true sense of Chinese nationalism. Therefore, it wasn't long after he inherited his father's armies that he placed himself firmly with Chiang Kai-shek and against the Japanese.
Yet, by the same token, Zhang was still a young man. In 1928, he was more concerned with chasing women than he was with military strategy or the future of China. With his boyish good looks and sly smile, it's not hard to see why women flock to him. He's even rumored to have had an affair with Etta Chano, the very married daughter of Italian fascist Benito Mussolini.
Having an affair with the married daughter of a brutal dictator? Clearly thinking through the consequences of his decisions was not his strong suit.
He also struggled with drug addiction. He had started using opium in 1927 as a way to deal with the pressures of military life. According to Zhang, quote, "An army doctor tried to help me by using a dose of medicine to get rid of the addiction. In the end, I got rid of the opium, but became addicted to the medicine," end quote.
Not surprising, considering that medicine was morphine, which is basically an even more addictive form of opium.
It's said there wasn't a place on his back where he had not pricked himself with a morphine needle.
Though Zhang's drug addiction had become a true burden on his health and well-being, the impetus to get clean did not come until 1931.
On September 19th, 1931, Japanese spies planted explosives on one of their own railway lines in the Manchurian capital of Mukden. The explosion caused minimal damage, not even enough to stop the trains from running. But the Japanese blamed the explosion on the Chinese. They used it as an excuse for a full-fledged Japanese invasion, citing the need to bring order to the lawless and chaotic state of Manchuria, which, to refresh, was the Chinese territory the Japanese had been slowly sending troops to, and the home state of Zhang Xueliang.
Within 24 hours, Japanese soldiers had seized Mukden. Reinforcements arrived, and Zhang looked on in horror as the territory he had fought so hard to hold was overtaken by the same people who had orchestrated his father's murder. The Japanese quickly established a puppet government under the leadership of the overthrown Qing Emperor.
Zhang was devastated, but with his drug addiction, he was in no state to defend his home, and neither was the Chinese government.
Protests were held all over China against the Mukden incident, but Chiang's forces were still engaged against the communists and warlords to the south. Chiang knew the Japanese were too powerful of an enemy for him to defeat while his armies were divided. Instead of fighting them, he needed a scapegoat.
Zhang, broken and in the throes of addiction, agreed to take the blame for Chiang. According to Edgar Snow, an American journalist living in China at the time, quote, Zhang never wavered in his loyalty to the older man, in whose judgment and sincerity he placed full confidence. He evidently believed Chiang Kai-shek when he said he was preparing to recover Manchuria, end quote.
Zhang resigned from his post and handed over his army to Chiang, citing his, quote, failure to inspire confidence in his troops and direct the campaign properly, end quote. Then, at the urging of a friend, he traveled to Shanghai to undergo treatment for his morphine addiction.
As Zhang checked himself into the rehab clinic, his father's final words to him echoed through his head, quote, look at you, addicted to drugs, involved with women. When I die, what will become of your family, end quote.
He had to get clean to avenge his father.
While modern treatment programs use weaning medicines like methadone to curb the most painful symptoms of opiate withdrawal, Zhang quit cold turkey. It was a brutal process. At least one patient had died from this method of detox.
But after 10 days, he was clean. When Zhang returned to China in 1934, he was fully recovered from his crippling addiction. He looked and felt better than ever.
Chiang Kai-shek agreed to restore Zhang's army and position under the condition that he combine his forces with another general's, the warlord Yang Huchang. He tasked their armies with quelling the ever-present communist problem.
However, Chiang Kai-shek had just unwittingly introduced the two men who would organize his kidnapping.
After the break, we'll learn more about the relationship between Yang Huchang and Zhang Shuliang.
Now, back to the story. In October of 1935, Chiang Kai-shek unknowingly brought together the two men who would eventually orchestrate a coup against him, General Yang Huchang and Zhang Shuliang.
Yang Huchang was a plump, bespectacled man plagued by rheumatism. He shared little in common with his suave new colleague.
Where Zhang had been born into status and privilege, Yang came from a family of peasants, rising to power as an illiterate bandit in the central province of Shenxi. Despite his humble origins, Yang's continued military victories established him as the foremost warlord in Shenxi. He rose to power in a similar way Zhang's father had.
In 1930, Yang participated in a rebellion against the Kuomintang government. When faced with defeat, Yang pledged himself to the Nationalist Army.
He was a pragmatist, a man more motivated by survival than any kind of lofty ideological goals. He aligned himself with the Nationalists under the adage, if you can't beat them, join them.
Yang had two wives, which was pretty normal in China at the time. One woman his parents chose for him, and the other he chose, a progressive and former communist.
Upon the completion of his mansion in Xi'an in 1936, when the two women refused to move in together, they hated each other. His pragmatic solution? He would live alone.
Journalist Edgar Snow described Yang as a rugged peasant who might once have had high dreams of making a big change in his world, but who, finding himself in power, looked vainly for a method and grew weary and confused.
He never had the same naive and unflagging loyalty to Chiang Kai-shek that Zhang Shuliang did. He didn't have the same confidence that Chiang would fight the Japanese. And it may have been this wariness, this refusal to grow close to the Generalissimo, that sealed his eventual doom.
By 1936, Chiang Kai-shek was at the height of his power, commander-in-chief of China's armed forces and president of the Chinese Nationalist Party. He was close to completely eliminating the struggling remnants of the communist forces, his top priority.
But to Zhang and Yang, a larger threat was being ignored. The Japanese government was increasing its hold on northern China. They urged Chiang to mount a defense, but instead, Chiang withdrew 180,000 Chinese troops from areas where they might be provoked by Japanese occupiers.
Adding insult to injury, the Japanese launched a campaign of economic and social sabotage in Manchuria. They smuggled in goods to sell, undercutting the cost of local manufacturers and gravely damaging the already fragile economy.
They encouraged and enabled narcotics abuse to demoralize and weaken the Chinese people. In Beijing alone, 300 drug dens sprung up, authorized by the Japanese puppet government.
Zhang watched as the people of his homeland fell prey to the same corruption that had held him captive for years. Yang saw his chances for economic success crumbling before his eyes. But without Chiang Kai-shek's approval, Zhang and Yang were powerless to stop the Japanese destruction.
Day by day, pressure to mount a resistance was building among the people. In Shanghai and Nanking, students staged protests and hunger strikes. Before long, their anger bubbled over into violence.
Rioting broke out at a Japanese-owned mill in Shanghai. In Chengdu and Guangdong, Japanese civilians were stabbed to death and mutilated by angry mobs.
Yang kept his opinions to himself, but Zhang made his position very clear. How could Chiang justify the recovery of territory from the communists, in his words, inch by inch, while it lost its territory to the foreign aggressors province by province?
But Chiang held stubbornly to his position. He would not attempt a resistance campaign against the Japanese until the communists were entirely neutralized.
Now, as it turns out, Chiang had made some weak efforts at an armistice with the communists in preparation to fight the Japanese. Back in 1932, he had set up a secret council to facilitate talks between communist leader Zhou Enlai and one of his lieutenants.
His conditions for peace were twofold, that the Red Army disband and they agreed to follow Sun Yat-sen's three principles. In return, the communists would be allowed to set up an autonomous government in one of the northern provinces. Negotiations broke down early on and little progress was made.
And this was all kept under the strictest confidentiality. As far as Zhang knew, Chiang had no interest in brokering peace with the communists.
On top of this, Chiang's direction seemed to contradict Sun Yat-sen's first principle of a unified, diverse China. Instead of attacking the Japanese, Zhang's armies were told their enemy was their fellow countrymen.
In Zhang's own words, "I did my best to follow orders, but the soldiers were not stupid. They knew that if they lost men or ammunition, they would not be replaced, so they were unwilling to fight."
Zhang was told that if he would not cooperate with fighting the communists, he would be replaced by a general who was willing to follow orders.
So in an effort to save his homeland, Zhang sought his own alliance with the forces he'd been instructed to eliminate. He arranged to meet with communist leader Zhou Enlai.
In April of 1936, Zhang traveled to a spired Catholic church nestled beneath a rocky outcropping in northern China. There, he met with Zhou. Zhang and Zhou agreed they would form a united front against the invaders.
Zhang agreed to allow the communists to set up a secret base in Xi'an, where his own forces were located. There, they waited for the right moment to strike together.
They assumed their common enemy would be the Japanese. Instead, it was the Generalissimo.
On October 31st, 1936, Chiang celebrated his 50th birthday. It was an elaborate affair featuring a cheering crowd of 20,000 people, a 21-gun salute, an air show of 100 American aircraft, and an hour-long parade.
After the party, Chiang met privately with Zhang to discuss the situation in Xi'an. where Zhang's men had stopped fighting the communist after Zhang's secret treaty with Zhou Enlai.
Zhang told Chang that his men were refusing to fight the communists because, as soon as they got within earshot, the opposing soldiers would taunt them, asking why the Chinese were fighting against each other instead of the Japanese.
Later, Zhang would tell his friend and advisor, William Henry Donald, that, quote, it was difficult to combat these arguments, for they were absolutely right, end quote.
But Chang was unmoved. He told Zhang that anyone who defied him on this matter was an enemy of the state. Zhang left the meeting furious. He would not stand by and watch his homeland be invaded and his people exploited.
When Zhang returned to Xi'an later that week, he told one of the Red Army lieutenants that he planned to stage a coup d'etat. With Yang's help, they would kidnap the generalissimo the next time he came to Xi'an and assume control of the army.
Yang and Zhang laid out the broad strokes of the kidnapping. Whenever Chang visited Xi'an, he always made it a point to stay at the Hua Qing hot springs outside the city in territory controlled by Zhang. It was an expression of his trust for the young general.
Zhang's forces would carry out the actual kidnapping, while Yang's men would fend off any supporters who tried to come to his aid.
The two men anticipated that once Chang was imprisoned, an avalanche of support would come from various political sectors. The idea of a united front would take hold in the government and in the minds of the Chinese people. Chang would have no choice but to cooperate. At that point, they would free Chiang Kai-shek, allowing him to lead China in war against Japan.
In the weeks leading up to his visit, Chang flooded Xi'an with members of his secret police, the Blue Shirts, specifically to keep tabs on Zhang and his military partner, Yang Hucheng.
Both Zhang and Yang were aware of the Blue Shirts' presence. If anything, the constant surveillance had only served to exacerbate the two commanders' frustrations with Chang, fomenting it into outright rage.
Yang and Zhang took countermeasures, rooting out spies and sending their own men to feed Blue Shirt operatives misinformation. They were ready when Chang came to Xi'an on December 10, 1936.
Chang had been warned that the trip could be dangerous, but thanks to Yang and Zhang's countermeasures against the Blue Shirts, he had no inkling of the coming coup.
On the day of his arrival, a group of leftist students staged a protest against Chang's presence in Xi'an and the continued Japanese occupation. The Blue Shirts fired on the group for sowing dissonance.
Zhang intervened to keep the violence from escalating. He promised the students that he would plead their case to Chang personally later that evening.
When Chang arrived later at the Hua Qing Hot Springs, he ordered Zhang and Yang to eat dinner with him. He made it very clear that if Zhang did not attend this meal, his replacement would not just be imminent, but immediate.
The perpetually stubborn Yang refused to go, so Chang and Zhang endured a strained evening alone together.
Though Zhang and Yang had outlined the plan for the kidnapping, Zhang had not yet agreed to go forward with it. He still had reservations about this betrayal. It was an insane gamble and possibly a suicide mission.
But when Zhang brought up the students protesting Japanese occupation, Chang responded with his classic temper. He raged, quote, let them come and I can use a machine gun to kill them. Chang screamed at Zhang for daring to try and represent both sides.
Zhang did not ask how Chang could imagine using machine guns on innocent students instead of on the Japanese. He gritted his teeth and clenched his fists. The match had been lit.
And so in the early morning hours of December 12, 1936, Yang and Zhang organized their forces. 10 of Zhang's closest military confidants came to meet Yang and finalize the details of the plan. They named the operation the Double 12 Revolt, after the date of the planned abduction. At 3:30 a.m., they set their plan in motion.
Under cover of darkness, Zhang's and Yang's forces crept through the ancient stone walls and fortifications surrounding the city of Xi'an. They surrounded Chiang Kai-shek's blue shirts while they slept, and the governor and chief of police were taken prisoner. At a nearby airfield, 50 Nanking bombers and their pilots were seized by mutineers. The Xi'an police force surrendered. Zhang and Yang had taken the city of Xi'an quickly, silently, and mostly bloodlessly.
20 miles away, Captain Sun Ming-chu, a baby-faced 26-year-old, led 200 men toward the compound at Hua Qing Hot Springs. They'd been warned that anyone who harmed Chang would be shot, but the same had not been said of Chang's men.
By the time Captain Sun Ming-chu burst into Chang's study, the room was empty and the courtyard outside was littered with bodies. The young captain walked to the open window, where curtains fluttered in the cold winter breeze. Outside, a trail of footprints in the snow led away from the building.
At the end of the footprints, Chiang Kai-shek had made it to the 10-foot wall that surrounded the compound.
He reached the top of the wall, only to find a steep 30-foot drop below him.
He began his descent.
But it was dark, and Chiang was barefoot. He wore only a thin robe. He slipped on the icy wall and fell.
When he hit the ground, a searing pain screamed up his back. For 10 minutes, he lay in motionless agony. Finally, he struggled to his feet.
He made his way to a small temple outside the resort where some of his bodyguards were on duty. They quickly came to his aid.
Chang's guards helped him escape further up the mountain, but Captain Ming-chu's men were in hot pursuit. Bullets whizzed by Chang as he made his way through the frozen brambles.
Several of Chang's bodyguards were shot dead beside him. He knew it wouldn't be long before he was next. He had to find a place to hide.
Finally, he found a cave set into the mountainside. He hunkered down, drawing his thin robe around him, and waited.
At this point, Chiang wondered if this was an attack by the communists or the Japanese. The last thing on his mind was that it was his own men. As Chiang sat hunched and shivering in the cold, Captain Sun Ming-chu and his men searched the mountain.
Twice, men passed by the cave but missed Chiang.
Eventually, through the gunshots and explosions, Chiang overheard two men arguing nearby, and one of the voices was Zhang Shuliang's. The cold reality washed over Chiang. This wasn't an attack. It was a revolt.
Soon the men drifted away, and the sounds of gunfire died out in the valley below. Chiang realized that all who would defend him had been defeated. He heard someone say, "Look, here is a man in civilian dress. Probably he is the Generalissimo."
Chiang rose painfully to his feet and called out to them, "I am the Generalissimo."
Chiang Kai-shek surrendered himself and was taken hostage.
Next time on Hostage, the negotiations for Chiang's release begin. We'll also explore how Chiang's powerful personality turned a kidnapping on its head. We'll talk about the psychology behind Chiang's eventual change of heart, learn about the colorful and unlikely characters who obtained a peaceful resolution to the crisis, and the tragic fates of his kidnappers.
You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen. We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Zoe Louisa Lewis and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.